The state of Tennessee is one of the few places where the sounds are just as breathtaking as the sights.
Whether that's live music at a historic music venue, the crack of an open fire at a campsite in the wilderness, or hearing kids laughing as they explore what's right around the bend, Tennessee just sounds perfect.
Start planning your trip at tnvacation.com. Tennessee sounds perfect.
This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise. All things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands, not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly Boring Since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association member, FDIC.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all.
Join Graham Class as he hosts Season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI.
Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow.
Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff Mom Never Told You from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Kristen.
And I'm Caroline.
And Caroline, I was traveling not too long ago and I was sitting in the airport reading a book called Breasts, A Natural and Unnatural History. And I'm not going to lie to you, I got a couple of sort of awkward looks from guys who were sitting next to me. And it made me more aware of, oh, I'm reading this book that says breast in large font on the cover. Okay. And I didn't care. I was like, if anyone wants to ask me about this boob book, no problem. And I got on the plane and started reading Breasts, and it was obviously very close quarters. And there was a woman sitting next to me also reading. And I noticed she had kind of looked over at my book a little bit. And I was like, oh, she's probably thinking about how I'm reading Breasts. And then I looked over at her book. And she was reading 50 Shades of Grey.
Ah.
And and from that moment on, once we kind of exchanged glances, we were like, cool, we're totally fine.
Neither of us is on an e-reader. We're owning it.
Although I will say that my book, Breasts, a Natural and Unnatural History by Florence Williams, far more educational than 50 Shades of Grey.
I'm sure some people would disagree.
Yeah, this is true. But I read Breasts, and it was such a great read that I reached out to the author, Florence Williams, to see if she could chat about it, because is there a better topic for Stuff Mom Never Told You than breasts?
I think it's tailor-made.
It is tailor-made. We've talked about bras before and cleavage before, but Florence really dug into the science and evolution of breasts, and also the intersection of breasts and the environment.
Yeah, the New York Times actually likened her book to Rachel Carson's 1962 Silent Spring, which really detailed the impact of industrial chemicals on animals and the environment. She takes that kind of scientific viewpoint and applies it to our breasts, talking about how the fatty tissue that sits atop our chests is like a magnet for chemicals and pollutants.
Yeah, and while a lot of the environmental interactions that she talks about in the book and that we also talk about in the interview are pretty unsettling, because it's all this stuff happening and it's affecting our breasts and getting passed out via breast milk to babies, and then all of those generational effects that take place. But she also touches on the evolution of breasts, the scientific study of breasts, which is often kind of brushed aside just because of how sexualized they are, and almost sexualized in kind of a comical way. And she also touches on the horrifying history of implants as well. Because not only are all of these environmental threats going on, but we're also paying money to have people tinker with our breasts and the size of them. So I was really happy to get Florence on the phone. Breast, A Natural and Unnatural History won the 2013 LA Times Book Prize for Science and Technology, and it was named the 2012 New York Times Notable Book. So you should definitely check it out. And huge thanks to Florence for talking with us.
Yeah, so let's hear what she had to say.
What got you interested in writing breasts?
It all started when I was nursing my daughter, and I found out that there were some toxic chemicals showing up in breast milk. So I thought it would be interesting to have my own breast milk tested to find out what was in there. And then, you know, write an article about that and kind of what it meant for my health and for my daughter's health. So we shipped off a vial of breast milk to a lab in Germany, and it came back positive for flame retardants and also trace amounts of pesticides. So that really launched me into this bigger question of how else modern life is changing breasts and what it means.
Well, what was one of the most surprising things that you learned with all of the research that you did for the book?
Well, it was just fun to learn about how kind of amazingly complex breasts are. You know, we tend to, in our society, of course, think of them in one way, and that's, you know, a sexualized way. And so I learned these amazing things about how they worked. I learned that, for example, when you're nursing, your breasts are incredibly smart, and they actually know when your baby is, for example, ill or suffering from an infection. And then your breast milk kind of adjusts its ingredients accordingly. For example, it will put more antibodies in the breast milk. And it looks like from primate studies that your breasts even somehow know if you're nursing a male or a female infant. And it changes also the composition of the fats and the proteins based on that. And then I also learned that actually breasts are very unique in the animal kingdom. You know, I kind of assumed that, well, all mammals have mammary glands, so there must be some other mammals out there, you know, that have mammary glands that sort of look like ours. But it turns out that the human breast is actually incredibly unique in the animal kingdom, and that no other primate actually has these sort of permanently enlarged mounds, you know, on their chest like we do. We have them starting in puberty, and then we essentially have breasts our entire lives. And with other primates, they really only have, you know, sort of what we would call breasts while they're lactating, and then they recede again. So I thought that was kind of interesting to know, in fact, how unusual breasts are. For example, our breasts are getting bigger in modern life, which was interesting to me and something unexpected. And also, of course, that they're showing up earlier now in younger and younger girls.
So the big question then, I mean, why, you're talking about how unique they are to humans. Why do we have them? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, yes, I can. And in fact, it's one of those kind of perennial biology questions, because a lot of people are interested in breasts, and a lot of evolutionary biologists have been asking this question for a while. You know, how did we get so lucky? Why do we have breasts and sort of no one else? And so there's actually a big debate about it. And for a long time, a lot of the sort of dominant theory in evolutionary biology has been that breasts must have evolved as a sexual signal for men, and that they must be a sexually selected trait. So that, you know, we have them because men are interested in them, essentially, and they must be conveying some kind of, you know, important information to men. But then in the 80s and 90s, you know, there were more kind of feminists in the field of anthropology, and some of them started questioning these theories and saying, well, you know, why should we assume that these breasts exist for men? You know, couldn't there be some other reasons that breasts exist? For example, to help the woman survive, or to help her infant survive. You know, is there something about breasts that, you know, enabled their fitness? So then it would be a more naturally selected trait and not a sexually selected trait. And so they have some alternative theories, mostly having to do with the fact that humans, human females and human infants, need a greater percentage of body fat. in order to survive. And in fact, breasts are a pretty good place to store body fat. And so because our breasts also have estrogen receptors, estrogen tells fat to be deposited in our breasts as well. And so it could be that it's this sort of combination of estrogen being in our breasts and the fat showing up there, that breasts are in a way kind of accidents of just being human.
Now, it's interesting. You talk about EvoBio, and obviously evolutionary biologists have spent a lot of time researching breasts, but it seems like outside of that area, and we also hear a lot about breast cancer research, of course, but one thing that you touched on a little bit in the book is how research on the function of breasts doesn't seem to be taken as seriously in the scientific realm, or was I just reading into that a little bit?
No, I think you're right. I think in many ways, breasts are a kind of orphan of science. I think because we sexualize them so much, it's harder to take them seriously as an organ. And in fact, a lot of scientists told me that they have trouble getting funding to research breast anatomy, or they have trouble, just being taken seriously studying things like breast milk, because there's not a lot of funding in it. And it's also, they feel that breasts are just not taken seriously. And in fact, it's true that breasts are the only organ in our body that don't have a medical specialty. So if you think about it, you know, our other organs, our kidneys, our livers, you know, they have this, you know, whole sort of specialty of medicine revolving around them. And we don't. In fact, when a woman gets breast cancer, you know, she goes to see a surgeon, or she might see her gynecologist, or she might see an endocrinologist. But these aren't specialties that are necessarily dedicated to the breast. And so because of that, we actually have a really limited understanding of how breasts work. We don't know, for example, why we get breast cancer. And breast cancer is such a complicated disease. It's actually the number one cancer killer of women globally. And in our country, in the United States, it's the number one killer of women in middle age. And so it's sort of amazing that we haven't spent more time trying to figure out how breast cancers start. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, breast milk. And I learned that we actually know very little about breast milk, even though it's this perfect food for humans. You know, we spend more money and more resources, more scientific energy studying red wine than we do studying breast milk. So I think that's kind of telling and interesting and sort of sad, really, you know, in terms of women's health.
Well, and it seems like when you're talking about all of the different medical specialties and how there isn't one for breasts, the first thing that popped into my mind was, well, we do have plastic surgeons. Is that the closest that we have to breast experts of sorts? And in the book, you talk about the history of implants, and really all of the horrific things that we have put into women's breasts over the years. Could you talk a little bit about why or how implants were invented, and especially this medical invention of micromastia, or having small breasts?
Yeah, sure. You know, for a long time, women were more concerned with having breasts that were too large. And so the earliest breast surgeries were surgeries that tried to reduce the size of breasts, because large breasts really got in the way, you know, of, for example, you know, farm work or field work for a lot of women. And so those are the first surgeries. And then it was actually the women on the stage who sang or were actresses who felt that it might be sort of beneficial to them to have larger breasts. And so the first breast augmentation was performed on an actress in Germany. And I think you had the date. I think it was about in the 1880s or 1890s.
1895 was the date, yeah, that you cited.
There you go. Thanks. You had good notes. 1895 was the first surgery to try to enlarge a woman's breast. And in that case, a surgeon took some fat from her backside and put it in her breasts. And it actually didn't work very well, because the fat sort of dissipated and migrated around and basically dissolved. And so since that failure, there have been 100 years of failures of trying to make women's breasts larger. And the history is just sort of this sorry history of environmental and health catastrophe sort of visited upon women in the name of medical experimentation. Doctors tried to augment women's breasts with ox cartilage, with wood chips, with glass balls. In the 1950s and early 1960s, they tried to use these new plastics, like even plastic sponges, very much like a kitchen sponge. And in many cases, these resulted in horrible infections, in hardening of the tissue. And it never seemed to work very well. And then in 1962, a surgeon in Houston, Texas, had the idea of using silicone, which had been a material invented for use in World War II. And the silicone was soft and it was cleaner. And so it was possible to use this as an augmentation material that wouldn't necessarily cause an instant infection. And it also tended to stay in place. So the first surgery was actually performed on a dog named Esmeralda. And she did not like her implants.
I can imagine.
She ended up chewing them out. She did not understand the need for this new endowment. And then, of course, it was performed on a woman. And the first woman, this operation was in 1962, and she's actually still alive. So I interviewed her for my book, which was really a lot of fun. She's in her 80s, and she's kind of proud, you know, of this place in history. And she jokes that when she dies, she's going to dedicate her breast to science.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire. With the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text snag to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise, all things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands, not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly Boring Since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association, member FDIC.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
Oldest girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by oldest girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I mean, that's so fascinating, though, that we've been so persistent, you know, for almost a century of trying to artificially augment women's breasts. But it seems like one of, you know, while we've been busily trying to put implants into breasts, there have also been environmental contaminants making their way into breast tissue. And you talk a lot about that in the book and about that and endocrine disruptors. So could you talk about some of the most directly, some of the chemicals that are most directly threatening to long-term breast health?
Yes. Unfortunately, breasts do seem to attract a lot of environmental contaminants and industrial pollutants. And there are a couple of reasons for this. One is that breast tissue is so fatty. It's you know, one of the fattiest parts of our bodies. And many industrial chemicals, such as pesticides, are fat-loving chemicals, are sort of attracted to fat. And once they get in fatty tissue, these industrial molecules, they tend to stay there for a very long time. In the case of DDT, for example, and flame retardants, which I also tested for in my breast milk, these are substances that last in mammalian fatty tissue for years and years and years. And PCBs, which are now banned, but were an industrial chemical used to sort of insulate electronics, they can last for decades. And so, sadly, I mean, some of the chemicals that we've been sort of accumulating in our breast tissue for, you know, since we were children, we end up passing along to our children. Some of the same ones end up staying there for the decades of our reproductive lives. So even the chemicals that our daughters are exposed to now when they're infants may still be in their blood and in their fat when they're having babies. So these are things that can last even for more than one generation in our bodies. And, of course, the question is really, well, what are they doing there? And unfortunately, the science is very young. It's only been in really the last 10 years or so that we've been able to sort of easily and affordably detect the presence of these chemicals. And scientists have been looking hard at animals and seeing what these substances do, you know, to lab animals. And it looks like some of them have the ability to affect our hormone systems. So they're what they call endocrine disruptors, and they can either mimic hormones or they can otherwise interfere with the hormonal signaling in our body. And these hormones are really important for regulating all kinds of biological processes, you know, from metabolism to, you know, sex drive and parenting behavior to neurodevelopment behavior and, you know, sort of how our brains work. For example, the flame retardants have been shown to particularly affect the thyroid system and the thyroid hormones. So what they're seeing in animals and now in some human studies is that animals with the highest number, the sort of largest number of these molecules in their bloodstream, tend to have sort of whacked out thyroid systems, either low thyroid or high thyroid. And the thyroid is very important, especially for infant brain development. So it also looks like that there are some human studies that are sort of confirming some of this too, that women who had the highest levels of these chemicals in their breast milk have infants and children with some potentially IQ and brain behavior differences. So it's something that, you know, I think a lot of people are very concerned about.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know you do some experimentation in the book to try to limit your exposure to chemicals, and you have to go to really extreme steps to do that. In the book, you do that for you and also for your daughter, including things of having to ride your bike around so that you're not coming into contact with these chemicals that are in the materials in our cars, for instance. So, I mean, knowing all that you know now, how can women protect their breasts? Because it seems like these environmental threats are unavoidable.
Yeah, you know, I think as mothers, we're all, you know, want to be cautious. I mean, we make our kids wear bicycle helmets, we make them wear seatbelts. We all kind of operate on a day-to-day level using the precautionary principle. And yet then we find out that there are all these industrial toxicants in use that have the potential to affect, you know, our children's brains and the timing of puberty for our children, which is something, you know, many of us are concerned about. And yet there's so little we can do to actually control their exposures and our exposures to these substances. So I wanted to find out, you know, if I really tried, could I affect, you know, for example, how many parabens or how much BPA I had in my bloodstream. And these are really common chemicals used in household personal care products, for example, shampoos or, you know, in our water bottles. And so I tried not to eat any food that had touched plastic. I didn't ride in my car for a few days because I didn't want to be exposed to the phthalates, which are another endocrine disruptor found in the interiors of our cars at off gas. And I became a vegan, and I didn't use smelly shampoos or moisturizers or deodorants for a few days. And I tested my blood and my daughter's blood both before and after. Doing these experiments. I'm sorry, I tested my urine and my daughter's urine because that's where these chemicals sort of end up. And I was able to alter the levels in my body about 80 or 90% for some of these substances. We tested for 5 or 6 of them. But for other substances, I could hardly budget even by living this sort of extreme, you know, no smelly substances life. Mm-hmm. It was a really disconcerting feeling that I actually could not control those exposures. And what it tells me is that we really don't know where these exposures are coming from. Part of that is because, you know, when we go to the grocery store and we buy a food product or we buy a shampoo or a soap, the manufacturers are not required to label those ingredients. So we don't know if our soap has phthalates in it or if it has triclosan, which is an endocrine disrupting antibacterial substance. Whereas if you go to Europe, for example, the manufacturers are required to label. So you can avoid substances more easily than you can in the United States. Moreover, the substances are everywhere. They're sort of in, you know, just in our homes. They might be in our roofing tiles. They might be in our, you know, home electronics. We just don't know. There are so many phthalates and there are so many products. It was overwhelming to me. And it made me feel sort of helpless. Mm-hmm. And it also made me feel sort of angry that, you know, our government has not worked harder to study these substances for health effects and has not really worked to regulate them when they do sort of appear to have some questionable health properties.
So it seems like almost the best that we can do is remain vigilant about, you know, maintaining awareness of the ingredients of food and whatever products when that information is made available to us. And beyond that, it seems like that's sort of all you can do maybe to protect yourself against environmental contaminants. Because obviously we can't, you know, live in, you know, vacuums away from all of these phthalates and parabens, et cetera.
Well, the problem with that strategy of trying to be vigilant is that it puts this tremendous burden, you know, on the individual and on the consumer to sort of figure this out. And it's just beyond us, frankly. I mean, you know, we're not, most of us are not chemists. We're not endocrinologists. And frankly, you know, we have enough going on, right? I mean, we're busy and we have other things to worry about, especially, you know, if you're a mother, there are lots of other things you're worrying about too. And so to add this to the plate, it just seems, you know, kind of impractical and, you know, frankly, just annoying. And so I was left with feeling like this shouldn't be my problem. This should be my government's problem. And it should be the manufacturer's problem. You know, really, let's not put, you know, if there are questionable substances, please, let's not use them. You know, let's find safer alternatives. And there are safer alternatives for many of these ingredients. And so I feel like if we want to do anything useful, it would be to sort of put more pressure on both state and federal governments to spend more resources testing these substances. I would like to see them tested for health effects specifically in the mammary gland, which is not done right now. Sometimes when chemicals are tested in a lab animal, for example, the mammary gland is just sort of thrown out. Like, no one's actually looking at effects on the mammary gland. And there were some activists who told me about this, and it just seems kind of crazy that, you know, we're living in an age of increasing breast cancer. It's such a strong concern among so many of us that really it would be helpful to look at sort of this target tissue rather than completely ignoring it. Mm-hmm. So I feel like there's a lot we can do as sort of activists or as just citizens to kind of, you know, ask for testing, you know, like they do in Europe. Why can't we do that here? And of course, there are a lot of complicated reasons for that. But with more consumer pressure and more citizen pressure, I think, you know, it's more effective than having us try to figure this all out on a case-by-case basis as we walk through the grocery store.
Well, you talk a lot in the book about being a mother. You know, you mention your children a number of times and talk about breast milk. And this relates to the issue with the environmental contaminants, because like you said, you know, those kind of contaminants can get into breast milk, et cetera. But in general, you know, there's all this information basically on how breast milk is kind of perfect in a way. So knowing, though, that scientifically, like, just how good breast milk is for babies, how do you think, though, that we as women kind of can balance that sort of scientific reality of knowing that, but also the realities of being working moms, perhaps, or maybe even women who just have a difficult time breastfeeding? Can you make some sense, I guess, of how to balance, I don't know, a working mom's life and then also knowing that perhaps, probably, breast is best?
Yeah, sure. I agree with you. Breastfeeding is it's complicated and demanding, and for working mothers especially, you know, sometimes it's hard to figure out the balance of, you know, how to be home enough, how to pump, how to get enough support to do it, and certainly for a lot of women, you know, it's too much, it's too difficult, and if they, you know, have to work, you know, right after their baby's born, you know, it has to be sort of up to them to figure out what's going to work best for them. And I think as women, we need to kind of support each other as we make these choices. But I do think that if you want to make an argument for which is better for your baby, formula or breast milk, you know, the science is really emerging more strongly that breast milk is a little bit better, especially for babies who are born early, for premature babies, and for babies who are born outside of Western industrial societies, you know, who are growing up in a pathogen-rich environment where they're exposed to dirty water, for example, you know, used to make formula. For those babies, breast milk is actually incredibly important for survival. It's a little bit harder to make the survival argument in the United States, where babies actually grow up just fine on formula. But what we're learning more and more is that nursing is also good for the mom. And I think that's really interesting, too. We know that when she nurses, she's mobilizing the fats that she's accumulated during pregnancy and giving them to her baby. And it actually helps her recover and sort of regain a healthy ratio of fats within her own body. So women who breastfeed are at lower risk later on, even, you know, decades later on, for things like heart disease and hypertension. And we also know that for the baby, you know, that there does seem to be an IQ benefit, although it's small, and also fewer respiratory infections and ear infections. We also know, and we're learning this more and more, that breast milk confers not just nutrients to a baby, but immune system support. So there are ingredients in breast milk that aren't actually digested by the infant, but that are digested by bacteria that is helpful to the infant. You know, we all have these very complicated communities of microflora in our bodies. And it turns out that those colonies are started, you know, the minute we're born. And breast milk is actually, you know, has evolved over really millions of years in mammals to sort of confer this colony that's that's most optimal for health. And so it looks like, you know, babies who are breastfed also have lower risks of allergies, for example, and asthma. And it's just kind of cool to think about, you know, how that's all evolved to sort of optimize our health. And it's something that formula companies, of course, are falling all over themselves to try to replicate, you know, some of these, for example, oligosaccharides that are just unique to human breast milk and nowhere else found on the planet. And they just have not figured out how to synthesize these products yet in formula.
Well, Florence, I could ask you so many more questions all about breasts. It was a fascinating read. But just to kind of wrap everything up, do you think that young women and even older women, for that matter, need to learn more about their breasts or be taught more about their breasts? Do we need better breast education?
Yeah, that's a great question. I really think we do. For one thing, young people learn about their bodies right now from the internet. And, you know, this is different, of course, from when I was growing up. And I saw somewhere a statistic that something like the average teenage boy will have seen something like 12,000 images of breasts, you know, by the time he finishes high school. And the sort of sad thing about this is that many of the breasts that these both boys and girls are seeing are not natural breasts. You know, they're either surgically altered breasts, you know, that are common in pornography, common in Hollywood, or they're photoshopped breasts. So this is also something that's really pervasive in media. And so I think both boys and girls are kind of growing up with this expectation of what breasts are supposed to look like. And I think, of course, that does a great disservice, you know, to the sort of wonderful variety of natural breasts that you see out there. And, you know, tends not to be so helpful for girls' self-esteem as they're growing up and their bodies kind of look different from an ideal. I also think that just the more we know about how breasts work and sort of how amazingly sort of complicated and miraculous they are, you know, the more that we will listen to them and what our breasts have to tell us, you know, as they kind of get sicker and as breast cancer becomes, unfortunately, more common throughout the world. It's really an important medical challenge to sort of figure out how to try to prevent breast cancer. And it's something that I think many of us can agree we're not spending enough resources on currently.
Mm-hmm. Well, how can we support working moms who also want to breastfeed, but obviously there's only so much time in the day?
I think there are a couple of ways that we can encourage and support breastfeeding. One is we can try to support breastfeeding in public, because right now there's a great level of discomfort in our society still with breastfeeding. And you see this when women are asked to stop breastfeeding in public, or when even they're arrested for breastfeeding in public. This is, you know, every once in a while you hear news reports of this, which I think is, you know, tragic. I mean, we are so comfortable with sort of boobs hanging out all over the place, right, in media and in billboards and in posters. And in lingerie shops. And yet, if a woman is actually just bearing a little bit of breast at a shopping mall because her baby is crying for food, you know, we ask her to leave. So I think, you know, I think it's important to kind of grow more comfortable with the idea of breastfeeding and to support it in public. I think one way to do that also is to encourage famous people and celebrities to breastfeed. And I loved it when Beyonce, you know, breastfed in public. I think that sent a really powerful message, and I think that can be helpful and supportive. And then, of course, there are social policies, too, that we don't have in this country that are common in many, many, many other countries. Longer maternal leave policies, for example, longer family leave policies, more support for women who stay at home a little bit longer. These have proven to be really effective for increasing breastfeeding rates.
Great. Well, if people want to learn more about you and learn more about breasts and where to get a copy of Breasts, where can people go?
Oh, thanks so much for asking. I do have a website. It's florencewilliams.com. And there are links to the book and a video about the book and more descriptions there. And the paperback is available now. It just came out last month. Really, bookstores everywhere. And there's also an audio version of the book and an electronic version of the book. So lots of ways to read it.
So thanks so much again to Florence Williams for really enlightening us about so many different aspects of our breasts that maybe people don't really think about that often.
Yeah, and I'll be curious to hear from especially maybe moms out there who have considered what is in their breast milk, both on that fascinating side of how nature seems to provide exactly the right compounds for whether it is a male or female baby, but then also the scarier side with those environmental contaminants as well. Let us know your thoughts. And don't forget to check out Breasts, A Natural and Unnatural History, published by W.W. Norton Company and written by Florence Williams. You can email us at momstuff@discovery.com or tweet us at momstuffpodcast or hit us up on our Facebook and leave a note there.
Snag a Job is where America goes to hire, with the deepest talent pool in hourly hiring. With access to over 6 million active hourly workers, Snagajob is the all-in-one solution for hiring high-quality employees who can cover all your needs. On demand, temp to hire, part-time or full-time. You name the position. Warehouse worker, retail associate, grocery store clerk, fitness trainer, baker, stylist, bellhop, podcast producer. Yeah, Snagajob's got a worker for that. With our easy-to-use platform, you're able to seamlessly post and fill available positions quickly, with a dedicated customer support team to provide all the help you need along the way. Kind of nice knowing you have a talent pool like that in your own backyard, right? Snagajob is the partner you need to keep your business running smoothly. So visit snagajob.com or text SNAG to 242424 to talk to an expert. Snagajob.com, where America goes to hire.
This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise. All things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands, not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly Boring Since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association, member FDIC.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV true crime podcast, To Live and Die in LA. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
And now, back to our letters. Kristen, I have one here from Athena about our pet parents episode. She has a slightly different experience from just the run-of-the-mill cats and dogs. She says, so I'm one of those who doesn't understand how crazy people get over their pets. That is, until about a month ago. My long-term boyfriend and I were adopted by an adorable bunny. I say adopted by because while at the shelter's Bun Run, where they let all of their bunnies out into a room where you can play with them, One bunny chinned us, marking us, and then chased off all other bunnies that wanted to come near us. That's a pretty territorial rabbit. My boyfriend has been hesitant about getting a pet, afraid of them dying, but her actions helped us decide then and there. So we brought our little flopster home and quickly turned into crazy parents. Rabbits need all organic vegetables, and so we now only buy organic for us so that she can have our vegetables too. We've built her cardboard castles and tunnels to play in, and now my boyfriend is talking about dressing her for Halloween. Can you tell that I'm just like overcome by the adorableness of this?
Yeah, I kind of want a bunny.
Shoot. Okay, me too. She says, while we one day, soon I hope, want a child, Flopster is a great friend to have. So while I cannot imagine ever pushing a pet in a stroller, I will not say never, since those big bunny eyes have already gotten me to do things I've said never to before. On a personal note, I would like to point out that bunnies are not great Easter presents for kids. Most of the bunnies in the shelter were Easter bunnies, rejected after the kids got tired of them. Bunnies will bond with their human owners, so this is heartbreaking for them to be rejected. Bunnies can die from heartbreak, she says. So thank you for your incredibly adorable story. I'm going to be happy the rest of the afternoon picturing Flopster playing in your cardboard castles.
And you know who else has pet bunnies and loves them?
Who?
Amy Sedaris.
Oh, yeah.
Which is why I really want a bunny now. Okay, well, this email that I have is from Jeff, and he is not down with pet parenting. So he just for background, he is married with a little girl, and he writes, pet parenting is something that has pissed me off since my sister referred to me as the uncle of her pet cats. I don't hate people loving their pets or even spoiling their pets. I hate the humanizing of animals. The fact that people would risk their lives or, as you pointed out, put the life of a pet over a human just sickens me. I should explain that I don't look down on people who choose not to have kids or can't have kids. Honestly, I think there are too many people in the world to sustain it. I didn't realize how prevalent the pet parenting trend was, though, until this past Mother's Day, when my Facebook wall was flooded with Happy Mother's Day to all parents of pets. So my response was a simple status update of pets aren't children. And wow, did that blow up quickly. Friends were telling me about how they risked life and limb to protect their pets, and some of these people had actual children too. All I could think was, imagine your child losing their parent because Fluffy was going to be hit by a car. It seemed preposterous to me. But again, I don't find fault in pet ownership until they start to anthropomorphize their pets. We even own a cat who snuggles on my chest every night. I like the cat a great deal. We had two cats, but one ran away. And while I didn't cry or get upset about it, I was sad because it wasn't adjusted to the outside. Anyway, those are my thoughts as an anti-pet parenting person. And there were a couple of other people who wrote in similarly saying, I don't get it. Pets are not people. Take off that tiny, tiny shirt that is on that dog ASAP. So thanks, Jeff, and everyone else who has written in. MomStuffDiscovery.com is where you can send your letters and pictures of your pets, especially if they are bunnies. And you can also tweet us at MomStuffPodcast, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Tumblr at StuffMomNeverToldYou.tumblr.com. And of course, you can also find us and watch us on YouTube. We're at youtube.com/stuffmomnevertoldyou, where we have like 60 or something videos up, so you should go watch them, and don't forget to subscribe.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com.
This episode is brought to you by PNC Bank, who believes some things in life should be boring, like banking.
Because boring is safe and responsible, level-headed and wise, all things you want your bank to be.
You don't want your bank to be cool or sexy. Sexy is for 80s hair bands, not banks. That's why PNC Bank strives to be boring with your money so you can be happily fulfilled with your life.
PNC Bank, brilliantly boring since 1865.
Brilliantly boring since 1865 is a service mark of the PNC Financial Services Group, Incorporated. PNC Bank, a National Association member, FDIC.
Diamonds Direct Spring Sale starts this weekend. Get 20% off rings, earrings, pendants, bracelets, and more. It's the best store-wide sale of the season. Plus, book an appointment and get an additional $100 off. That's 20% off plus $100 off store-wide. And enjoy an expanded selection of the latest styles with designer appearances each weekend. Tons of engagement rings on sale, too. 20% off starts Friday and open Sundays. Details at DiamondsDirect.com.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are coming back to Atlanta.
Right now.
Whoa. Mark your calendars because the second annual Black Effect Podcast Festival is happening on Saturday, April 27th. Hosted by B-Dot and Pretty V. Last year was nuts, but we about to do it bigger and better. We've got some of your favorite podcasts like Carefully Reckless, Horrible Decision, $1 million Worth of Game, just to name a few. Tickets go on sale today, right now. Go to blackeffect.com/podcastfestival. Get them. We'll see you there.